your patience, we're now ready to move on to the Graves case. Next is Dalton, is that correct?
Yes.
And Ms. Dalton, do you desire to reserve any time for rebuttal?
Yes, please, 5 minutes.
Certainly.
May it please the court, my name is Dorian Dalton, here on behalf of Veronica Graves. This is a sufficiency argument, essentially that there was not sufficient evidence to convict Graves of contempt where there was no evidence of misbehavior in the presence of the general district court or any otherwise that she violated the contempt statute 18.2456. Briefly, on October 17, 2013, Graves' charge of possession of marijuana was taken under advisement. She returned to court on October 23, 2013 to the general district court to request a restricted driver's license and was drug tested. The drug test was positive for THC, cocaine, and morphine. Graves was found in contempt in general district court based on the positive drug test. Graves appealed that finding of contempt to circuit court. In circuit court, she was again convicted of contempt based on the general district court's order and certificate. However, the order and certificate stated no facts supporting the finding of misbehavior or even why she was drug tested. The only fact contained in the order and certificate was that she requested a restricted driver's license and that she tested positive for THC, cocaine, and morphine. The conclusion stated in the order and certificate from general district court was that Graves appeared in court under the influence of drugs.
Ms. Dalton, can I ask you on that? When Judge Covito made his ruling, he was looking, obviously, at the certificate and order. And the order talks about that she did test positive for THC, cocaine, and morphine. And then it says, it is adjudged that Veronica L. Graves is guilty of contempt of court in that she did appear in court while under the influence of drugs. Couldn't Judge Covito, as the circuit court judge, infer from the certificate that was sent up by the general district court judge, and we're not, of course, in a de novo situation here, he considered the general district court record in a contempt case. Couldn't he infer that the general district court judge, by putting that in the order, in that she did appear in court while under the influence, that meant he observed something in her behavior or appearance beyond simply that there was a positive drug test?
I would suggest to the court that in this case that would be an unreasonable inference, and I would point the court towards the case of Carter v. Commonwealth from 1986. In this court, where the Carter court held that it is of the utmost importance that as near as possible the record recites the facts or contains the evidence to support the conclusions of the court making the original finding of contempt. The record in such cases must contain more than the bare conclusion the defendant's conduct violated the statute. The actual facts upon which the court based its final conclusion must be set out. Such conclusions alone will not support a criminal contempt adjudication. And in Carter, this court explained that the reason behind the requirement of detailed facts is that the courts, although recognizing the summary nature of direct contempt proceedings, try to limit to the absolute minimum the dangers inherent in such a type of legal proceedings. Even a right to review in such cases constitutes no guarantee against unjust or arbitrary judgment if the reviewing court is not afforded an opportunity to evaluate the facts upon which the decision had been reached. Thus, it has been stated that the purpose of this requirement is to enable the appellate court to determine by inspection of the record whether contempt has in fact been committed. And I would, to further respond to the court's question, state that the trial court would need to state any facts upon which it based inferences and its ultimate conclusion in order for the circuit court to properly make that finding. And in this case, there was no facts of her behavior at all, much less misbehavior, and there were no facts indicating why the drug test was given. Although defense counsel at trial represented to the court that routinely in general district court, traffic court, and city of Richmond, anyone requesting a restricted license is drug tested prior to being given that restricted license.
Judge Covito did say, Ms. Graves, I find that based on comments exhibit number one, which was a certificate and order we're talking about.
Yes.
That you did appear in district court while under the influence of drugs. That is contempt in my view. And that's pretty much all he says when he makes the finding. But let's look at the statute, if we could, the 18.2-456.
Yes, sir.
And it talks about that summary contempt, the first subsection is misbehavior in the presence of the court, come or so near thereto as to obstruct or interrupt the administration of justice. In this court's decision in Parham, it really parsed that and talked about, okay, if it's misbehavior in the presence of the court, you don't need to obstruct or interrupt the administration of justice, right?
Right.
Why? And so looking at the facts here, on October 17th, I believe, she pled guilty to drug possession.
I think it was taken under advisement. I don't think it indicates what the plea was.
I'm sorry. I thought she pled guilty.
She may have.
But at any rate, it was taken under advisement after she pled, and it indicated that it would be dismissed if she stayed. You know, she had to go through drug treatment. She had to do 24 hours of community service, certain things like that. And then there was an agreement with the Commonwealth for this deferred disposition where it would be dismissed.
Right.
So she's, let's just say for sake of my question, she did plead guilty, because I think that's right. And then she's got a deferred disposition sort of worked in where the Commonwealth's agreed with that.
Right.
6 days later, and she gets her driver's license suspended for 6 months. 6 days later, she comes in and asks for the privilege of a restricted driver's license, and she knows she's ingested drugs at some point, and she makes the decision to come to court 6 days later and ask for further privilege. She's already got the deferred disposition, and she's now asking for a driver's license, even though her license has been suspended. It's restricted, that's right, but so why, at this point, if she shows up with drugs in her system, whether they do the test as a matter of course, or whether the general district court judge just decides he feels like in this situation, given her plea of guilty to drugs, that why isn't it misbehavior in the presence of the court to choose to come to court that day to ask for yet another privilege?
Your Honor, I think it's not misbehavior because there is no evidence, one, that she knew that there were drugs in her system, and two, there's no evidence what level of drugs are in her system. Further, there's no evidence as to when she ingested the drugs. There's no indication, this is, again, a drug charge, but there is no indication, no evidence as to the drugs being ingested from the date that she went to court, October 17th, until the date that she requested the restricted license, October 23rd. And I would suggest to the court that the Bailey case, which I cited in my brief, stands for the proposition that even where evidence proves a positive drug test, where no evidence establishes the likely duration of a particular drug in a person's body or the level of that drug in their urine, a judge has no basis upon which to conclude the time period during which that person ingested the drug. Therefore, without evidence of that, the court cannot conclude that she ingested the drugs between the date that she entered the taken under advisement situation until the date that she requested the restricted license.
So we would need to know when she ingested the drugs, essentially.
There would need to be evidence of that. And there's not even any evidence from the urine screen as to what levels of these drugs are in her system, just that there's a positive test.
If we follow your argument, then what you're basically saying is that in every courtroom in the Commonwealth, whether it be district court or circuit court or JNDR court, that people can come in under various illegal substances and come into court, sit through court, go through the proceedings, and that's not contempt.
Absolutely, that would be my argument, that the presence of drugs in someone's system.
Then how are we to assure, how are judges who sit in those courts, how are they to assure that that the particular, whether they be a complainant or respondent or a defendant in a criminal trial, how are they ever to assure if they see something that makes them suspect that someone's under some type of impairment? How are they ever to assure that that basically justice is meted out? Because you may have various people under the influence that have not much clue of what's going on.
Well, Your Honor, I think that there's an important distinction to be made between having drugs in your system and being under the influence of drugs. And that's a distinction that I think the trial court failed to recognize.
Okay, and the three, I understand your argument, but the three drugs that this particular person had in their system, THC, the marijuana, the cocaine, and cocaine is generally remains in the system for what? 72 hours? No longer than 72 hours?
Well, I would suggest to the court that even if the court has knowledge of how long a drug might stay in someone's system, that it would be the burden on the Commonwealth to introduce evidence as to how long drugs would stay in someone's system.
What was the other drug that she had in her
morphine.
System? Morphine. Okay. And
And THC, which is marijuana, too, right?
Right. Which was the drug she was charged
with. And she didn't offer any explanation for any of that, is that correct?
In circuit court? No. There was no evidence, I don't believe, presented by the defendant.
This may be sort of an oversimplification, but it seems to me that your argument boils down to that misbehavior, that term misbehavior, is restricted to the point that it isn't sufficient to constitute misbehavior to appear before a tribunal under the influence of a substance. That's not misbehavior. That's not an affront to the dignity of the court, basically, that to appear in court under the influence of an illicit drug, or maybe even not an illicit drug, but to appear under the influence.
I would, in response to your question, suggest that there was not sufficient evidence that Ms. Graves was under the influence, but that even if an individual or defendant appears in court under the influence, to violate the contempt statute, that would still necessitate behavior of some sort that violates the statute.
The state of being intoxicated is not misbehavior, is basically what you're saying.
I'm saying it's not necessarily misbehavior that some people can be under the influence of drugs and not necessarily even exhibit signs that they're under the influence, much less misbehave in front of the court.
Okay. But doesn't it show, as we talked about in some other cases from this court, doesn't it show disrespect for the court? And without respect for the court, if that's being shown by parties appearing before the court, that affects the very nature of our system of justice and the respect in which it needs to be held to function properly.
I would suggest to the court that disrespect to a court may be an oversimplification of what constitutes contempt. There are certainly several cases that make reference to the fact that, I think Parham for one, that people appearing before the court do not necessarily have to respect the court if they do not demonstrate their disrespect in a way.
But wouldn't, if you've pled guilty, you know you've been arrested several months before for possession of an illicit drug, marijuana in this case, and you plead guilty on the 17th to it, and then you go back 6 days later to try to get a driver's license, a restricted driver's license, after your driver's license has been suspended as part of your punishment, and you show up with marijuana again in your system, along with cocaine and morphine, three drugs this time, why isn't that, given what you just went through, given these particular circumstances, not something that a judge could find resulted in contempt? Because our standard of review here from this court is essentially, is the evidence sufficient enough, so rational fact finder standard of review, right?
Correct. Because the presence of the drug did not, there's no evidence that it caused her to misbehave. There's no evidence that it was not a drug metabolite still in her system from prior ingestion, nor is there any evidence as to how much was in her system. And there's no evidence that she knew that the drug was in her system, the drugs were still in her system when she requested the restricted license. And I think of most importance is just that the statute specifies five different ways that someone can violate and be held summarily in contempt, and there's no evidence that she misbehaved or violated any of the other four specific ways.
Can you help me with this then? Why did she have to be in court that day, other than her own desire to get a driver's license?
The only knowledge I have from the record is just to request the restricted license. It's the only reason she was appearing.
She could have come a week later, 2 weeks later.
Certainly.
Thank you.
Good morning. May I please the court? I'm Benjamin Katz, on behalf of the Commonwealth. And I'd like to begin really where you started, Judge Beals, and that's at page one of the appendix with the order and certificate of conviction, because I think that's an excellent place to begin the analysis. If this court, looking at the certificate from the General District Court, finds that the contempt finding was based on appearing in court under the influence, something that the trial court observed, something that was affirmed at trial de novo, then that really concludes this court's analysis of the sufficiency. And I submit, looking at this certificate in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth, as this court must do, that is sufficient evidence. At the proceeding before Judge Cavito in the circuit court at trial de novo, that was certainly the position of the Commonwealth, and I would point this court to page 24 of the appendix, that the defendant had appeared before the General District Court under the influence of drugs or marijuana, opiates, such that the General District Court observed this demeanor. And there was no evidence adduced at trial de novo to suggest that was not the case, and counsel points to the proffer of trial counsel at the de novo proceeding saying, well, this is done as a matter of course. That was refuted by the Commonwealth's attorney, and Judge Cavito made no ruling one way or the other. Simply put, there was not sufficient evidence before the trial de novo to suggest that was the explanation. And so viewing all of this evidence, as this court must do in a light most favorable to the Commonwealth, I would submit as an initial matter, we have a record that would say this person appeared before the General District Court such that their demeanor, their manner was observably affected by these drugs to support the finding of contempt. Counsel argues that the finding doesn't lay out specific facts to support the conclusion. And I would argue that the observation that the person was under the influence is the fact. The conclusion is that they must be held in contempt because of that fact. I would suggest there's nothing wrong with the certificate. But even if this court finds, in light of those arguments, that that is not sufficient, that the analysis must continue to the next step, and if this court chooses to reach the issue of whether being present in court with those drugs in your system is sufficient to support a contempt finding, I would argue that the Bailey case that counsel relies on, is materially distinguishable from this case. And the difference is, in Bailey, you have an admission to the probation officer, I took drugs before the sentencing. And you have a positive drug test the day of sentencing, and then you have approximately 5 days later a second positive test. And in Bailey, the court said, well, we can't tell under those circumstances which drug use occasioned the positive drug test. I don't think Bailey can be read to say you may never be held in contempt when you have the positive presence of drugs in your system. It's when we can't say, well, which test are we talking about? Which test references the use of drugs? It's under that circumstance that a court cannot do that. We don't have that here. We don't have any admission from the defendant saying, well, I took it before the proceeding, and the fact that you're testing it now is related to that earlier consumption. We don't have that. We don't have any scientific evidence of the rate at which these drugs are metabolized. Counsel makes a great deal of argument about the fact that it could have been in the system from a time prior and it's merely being picked up at this late date. That evidence wasn't before the trial court. All we know is that these drugs were in the system without an admission.
It sounds like her argument, though, is that we don't know because it could have been weeks ago that marijuana takes a while to get through the system. And the Commonwealth needs to put that on if it's going to prove its case.
Well, I would submit respectfully that is an hypothesis of innocence that is being floated by counsel, but it is a hypothesis of innocence that is not supported by any evidence. The Commonwealth presented the positive evidence of you were in court on this date with drugs in your system. And the hypothesis of innocence would be, well, that's true, I did, but let me tell you about when I consumed it. So I would submit under that scenario that the Commonwealth has met its burden by adducing positive evidence of drug use. And it would then be upon the defendant to say, well, but there's an innocent explanation for how I came to be in court that day with the drugs in my system. So I would argue that it's the defense that hasn't presented the appropriate defense.
So you would argue even if the, and this is usually done by your analysis test, right? that if in the urine sample it showed just a tiny amount of a drug, cocaine, or in this case a tiny amount of cocaine, morphine, and THC, then that's enough.
I would submit that a prima facie case may be made by that showing, which would then allow someone to mount a defense by offering myriad evidence of the scientific ways to explain how it could be present in your urine and how you would not be under the influence of that narcotic or drug. That it could certainly be done. It was not done in this case.
But you think it's incumbent upon her to show that it was very small and therefore it would not have affected her appearance or behavior in any way?
Well, and I think a difference can
be made.
So
she was under the influence.
Sure. I think a difference, and a significant difference for the analysis, is if, say, if the charge hypothetically were possession of the drug, well, merely showing it in your urine wouldn't be sufficient to show that it's in your dominion and control such that you may be said to possess it. And that's why we don't see this scenario in cases that often. We see it in the probation context because it is a significant difference having it in your urine when you've been ordered not to do it versus have you possessed it. And so I submit showing it in your urine is a prima facie showing that, you know, you've used it. You shouldn't be using that substance. It wouldn't demonstrate possession for the purpose of the initial conviction, but I think it is significant in this context and the context in which it came up in this specific case. So I would argue that the Commonwealth met its burden by demonstrating this evidence. And we don't have any response as to what it means scientifically, why it would not be significant scientifically. We have a lot of argument in that regard, but I would submit there's simply no evidence to support that argument. I'd be happy to answer any questions the panel may have.
Thank you. Ms. Dalton, you used up most of your time, but we ask you so many questions, I'm going to give you a little bit of time to respond. I'll give you a couple of minutes.
Thank you. If I could just respond to the Attorney General's argument, I would suggest that their argument improperly burden shifts the burden to the defendant to prove what this drug test means, when in fact the burden is on the Commonwealth to, if this is the Commonwealth's evidence, to indicate what the results of the drug test were, and the results of the drug test were only positive, not levels. There's no expert testimony indicating what significance this has or how long it stays in someone's body. I would suggest it's not a reasonable hypothesis of innocence that we're putting forward, but rather the argument that the trial court's conclusion that Ms. Graves appeared in court under the influence of drugs was not supported by the evidence. The implication of a holding consistent with the trial court in this case would suggest that anyone who appears in court, in particular on a drug charge where they are required to appear in court, or on a probation violation, or on a pretrial violation resulting from positive drug tests, would indicate that any person appearing in court with drugs in their system would be in contempt of that court. And that reaching, I would suggest, is not consistent with the law of contempt. I'm happy to answer any questions the court has.
Thank you, counsel. We will come down and greet.